Welcome to the Better Money, Better World Show, a podcast project of Impact Capital Managers, or ICM. ICM is a group of investors who believe that by solving the world's greatest challenges, we will generate market-leading returns for investors while bending the arc of human history towards sustainability and justice. ICM members have backed companies ranging from Tesla to Coursera to Vital Farms. Collectively, ICM's 60 members manage over $12 billion. I'm your host, Daniel Pianco, a co-founder of ICM. My day job is co-founder and managing director of Achieve Partners, a leading investor in education and human capital. Here on Better Money, Better World, we'll explore the stories of our investor members, the companies we're building, and the limited partners allocating money to investors who don't just seek alpha, but also to leverage their capital to build a better world. Episodes will be released each week and feature a new guest telling their own unique investment stories, strategies, and perspectives. And we've got lots of great guests lined up. So, if you're excited about what this show might teach you about impact investing and the people behind it, make sure you subscribe to Better Money, Better World wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you're feeling generous, give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. It's a great way to highlight the work of impact investors and grow the community of impact investing. Now, with that out of the way, let me introduce you to our Better Money, Better World guests. Caprock has led almost 100 private impact investments in partnership with 40 different impact managers, including 20 impact capital managers through Mark Berryman and his colleagues. Caprock manages $8 billion of client assets and has deployed around $1.5 billion in impact-oriented funds. Berryman leads Caprock's impact investing business after previously serving as a lead investment officer at the International Finance Corporation and co-head of Deutsche Bank's Global Social Investment Funds Group. Berryman is a recovering camel rider, which he learned as a Peace Corps volunteer in Mali at the start of his career 25 years ago. Caprock has provided catalytic capital across a range of impact strategies by being an early backer of impact leaders like CIM's Enterprise Loan Fund, Greenbacker Capital, Sustainable Infrastructure, and emerging fintech group Lendable. Caprock has also helped anchor a range of funds like EdTech-focused Reach Capital's second fund. Due to Caprock's size and ability to move early, it can work closely with clients to structure bespoke funds, vehicles, and even advantageous fee arrangements. Driving catalytic capital towards impact fund managers has also delivered outsized returns to Caprock's clients with large positions in outperforming funds with impact and alpha like Elevar and Vision Ridge. Mark, welcome to the Better Money, Better World podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here. As I've told many of friends and peers, the ICM is probably my favorite impact organization because it's like a grassroots-led initiative by impact managers, many of whom are our friends and partners. So love it. Happy to be here.
That's great. And I understand you've backed over 40 impact managers, so we appreciate your support over the years. Now, I'm going to give you an opportunity. I am a family foundation with $100 million of assets, and I call you up. And I say, Mark, give me the elevator pitch on Caprock and why I should invest with you. What would you say?
I'd say $100 million is a wonderful balance sheet to have, and you have a wonderful problem to have. And that's a great, nice, sweet spot for a firm like Caprock. Our minimum is 10 million investable liquid assets, but that 100 million is just a great sweet spot. But before talking about Caprock, Pianco Foundation, we would say, you should definitely find a firm that can invest across all asset classes, can deliver on your impact objectives, and deliver your financial returns. And for that, we think Caprock is really well suited for you. I think first and foremost, we are designed and established and set up to operate like a single family office, 100% dedicated for you. We don't believe in model portfolios. You're going to have a bespoke, customized portfolio across numerous asset classes. And I think secondly, we have an impact investing authenticity that is really unrivaled in the industry. We were one of three wealth management firms to be founding B Corp members years ago when this started. And that just highlights early on our dedication to investing for profit and purpose at the same time. And I think since then, we've spent years and hours and time you know, contributing to impact investing research, participating in peer networks, and sharing our lessons learned. It's been a, you know, a long period, and we have more to learn, but we've definitely learned more than most in the industry. And third, and probably arguably the most important, is, you know, we have invested in probably more impact investment funds than most organizations out there compared to our peers. And that is, I know you hit on the number of 40. We've actually done 20, over 20 something ICM impact funds, but we've partnered with well over 40 impact managers and have invested in over 90, just shy of 100 impact investment funds and direct projects or co-investment opportunities, just to highlight that we have this really rare ability to deliver on all three of those things that we believe is important: cross-asset classes, delivering your impact objective, and of course, delivering on your financial goals.
So Caprock has created this great reputation as an investor in the space. I know you've contributed that greatly. What made you join Caprock, you know, 5 or 6 years ago? And what was the kind of impetus for you to be excited about this opportunity?
It's funny. I heard about Caprock, I want to say maybe 2013, by, you know, a friend and peer in the industry, you know, Stephanie Rupp at Verus. This was when she was leaving OMIDR and starting at Tonic to be the CEO at Tonic. She said, "Mark, have you ever heard of Caprock? You know, be great there." And I was like, "Huh?" And I looked at the website, because I was working for the IFC at the time, in a completely different kind of world of how we thought of impact investing. And it was years later, when I was thinking about my next kind of future and you know, final home in terms of a professional career, that I stumbled upon Caprock again and started meeting with colleagues. And it was there that I was incredibly surprised of what they had done to date in impact investing and all of the great work that they have built, including building an impact reporting portal, you know, having amazing clients that have done groundbreaking impact investments. And it was really that that really kind of pushed me over the ledge to decide to join Caprock. And of course, there was numerous things for me to learn when I joined Caprock, and that was part of the reasons that I've learned so much since I've joined the firm.
So now, one of the things that makes what you do really unique is that you can serve as a catalytic force in helping to mobilize private capital. Can you talk about a fund or investment or deal where you, Caprock, and Mark were really early and helped mobilize additional capital over time?
Yeah, there's a handful of examples, and they're great. They're great examples of how we often think about mobilizing clients into these catalytic funds, and even how we think about structuring them. Three, I would say, it kind of goes historically. One would be CIM, Community Investment Managers, and their Enterprise Loan Fund. We were really early on. We supported the GP, and we really brought in a lot of our clients as that was ramping up. And today, it's a super successful fund, well over 200 million. But we were willing to go in early on. A second example, totally different impact theme and sector, would be Greenbacker, which is a portfolio of wind, solar, biomass, and energy storage assets. It's now well over $1 billion. And we joined when it was 1/12th, 1/15th at the time. We knew it had scale. We knew it was incredibly important for our clients. And we worked really closely with Greenbacker to come up with special terms for our clients, which really gets our clients really excited about. By being a Caprock client, they're able to have like a special class or special rights that others did not have. And we continue to do that. And I think a third example is Lendable, similar to CIM. This one is emerging market focused. They invest in innovative fintech companies in frontier and emerging markets. We came in as one of the two main anchors to ramp this up. And I wish I could tell you the dollar amount, but we've really brought in tons of our clients because they thought it was a really unique structure. And we worked really closely with Lendable to create a special kind of class and product for Caprock clients. And that really helps mobilize capital. And now that is, you know, well over 150 million within a year. Just great example of how we worked with another partner to build that fund to where it is today.
So you create kind of bespoke deal flow for your investors.
And often special terms, maybe there's first loss, or we have a reduced fee, or we'll often have a higher yield, you know, something that's not available to every other investor.
One of the things that I find interesting about your approach is you come up with a thesis either generated from the client demand or from your own kind of interest. Can you describe a thesis that you identified and then a fund that you went after to invest in that thesis?
Yes. You know, many times we're trying to find funds that are applicable to all of our clients, but sometimes we'll have one client or a handful of clients that are really interested and focused on a specific impact theme. One example was, this was in 2018, many of our clients really wanted to invest in a gender lens focused fund. And I want to say around that time, like 70 to 80 seed and venture gender lens funds were launched and super important, right? A lot of female entrepreneurs have been left out of the venture system. There weren't that many venture capital funds led by women prior to that. So just a huge dearth of necessary capital. But we wanted to partner with the group that we thought was the best. One that had scale, one that had track record, and that was Rethink Impact. And so we waited, we were patient as they were thinking about their next fund. We did our due diligence and are super happy to partner with them. As you know quite well, you know, Jenny and Heidi are superb. But that was one where our clients were really focused on investing in a gender lens fund. And we waited and waited until we found that one that had that scale, the track record, but was also investing in impact businesses led or owned by women. Another example is we have a foundation who's very, very focused on education, particularly early childhood development. And so with that very specific thesis, we sought out one of our existing impact managers focused on education, and we helped structure a seed fund specifically for early childhood development ventures. Two different situations, but great examples of where that impact thesis led us to either wait and find a great partner or work with one of our existing impact managers.
Well, Jenny and Heidi were former guests on this show, so we'll have to go back and put that in the show notes. You don't just serve catalytics. Sometimes you actually anchor funds as well. Tell us about a fund that you're particularly proud of having anchored.
I'll use two examples, both of which are in education, and I'll piggyback on that one example I just talked about. And we anchored our client in that specific fund, whereby they would sit on the LPAC, they would have co-investment rights because they too wanted to invest in early childhood development. So this was with Learn Capital, and the fund was called Learn Start. So we essentially structured it from term sheet to, you know, final agreement, and we put our client in as the anchor. The other one in education was, and you know, 2020 was the year of education because of the pandemic, and numerous funds were launching education funds. And we had already invested in a few and are super proud of our education managers, but we thought about bringing on a new one, and we scanned the market. And we ended up selecting and partnering with Reach Capital, another ICM manager. And lo and behold, our clients loved it. Super diverse team. Had shown that they know how to exit despite, you know, sometimes smaller funds and younger vintages, just a great exit track record as well. And we ended up being the second largest investor in that fund amongst our client base. So super proud of that again. So we didn't think we'd be the anchor, and we ended up being the anchor.
The accidental anchor.
There's a movie there.
On your bio, it talks about riding camels in the desert. So maybe we'll combine those two things. So in all of these, there's sort of an embedded impact thesis. Can you talk about how sort of you think about your impact thesis drives financial returns?
Yes, I think the two need to be intertwined. When we think about impact investing, our asset managers, we're going to seek and partner with fund managers that are going to invest in a company or a project, if it's real assets, that are investing in a solution or a product that has an impact objective. And as that company, if it's a solution or a product or a service, has wider adoption amongst users and it grows and scales, that's more revenue. And so mass adoption growth of that impact solution or service to the underserved, or if it's a new technology for climate, that adoption and growth is going to lead to revenue. So these things need to be 100% intertwined. So increased revenue should increase the impact objective. That's how we think of it. And we've been really proud, particularly over the last year or two, with two managers that we've seen that. One would be Elevar. We are a partner in two of Elevar's funds, and Elevar 3 has recently completed a really successful exit in a e-commerce business in Latin America for small businesses, a widely successful exit. And that return really was based on that impact theme. Another one, completely separate in a different asset class, is Vision Ridge. We've been a partner with Vision Ridge in their first fund in 2015, the Sustainable Assets Fund. And that too has completed really successful exits that outperformed a real assets target. One was an EV charging infrastructure company, and the other was a sustainable ag business in California. Widely outperformed their target returns, but again, driven but intertwined with the impact theme and objective of that business model.
So I want to come back to this a little bit because, you know, you've talked about how when you talk about like the pitch for CapRock, you know, number two was impact across all the different pieces of it. You talk about having $8 billion under of assets under advisement, but only about $1.5 billion or so, or 20% of it or so is actually in impact. So how do you talk to your clients about sort of edging into impact or sort of allocating their portfolio across both quote unquote impact and non-impact type of products?
Sure. I think some people in the industry will often overemphasize how much they actually do in impact, maybe because they include ESG in it, or maybe they have a foundation client, but that foundation client may have yet to make an impact investment. So that $1.5 billion is important because it's not just a portion of your business, it's where you have invested. And for us, that's way more important than trying to come up with a percentage for a handful of reasons. You know, we're willing to do $1 million in a really unique niche important impact fund and a much larger investment in a separate fund. So that just shows you, right? We talked at the beginning of the meeting, you know, well over 40 impact managers and over 90 impact investments. It's what we've done. Coming to how can we make that 100% of our business? It's not that simple. While we do have clients that are 100% impact from cash to venture, we often are hired to help new families or family foundations start their impact journey, make their first impact investment. And maybe it's one the first year, maybe it's three, and maybe over time it's five, six, seven. But every client is going to have a different impact journey. And we're there to help onboard that, educate them, and make sure that we're placing their capital and impact investments that are important to them. So hopefully, sure, the way the world goes, it starts to increase in percentage amounts, but we're going to continue to get new clients that are starting that impact journey for the first time.
How long does that journey generally take?
Every client is different. It can be super quick, depending on their risk appetite, you know, what they want to do, what type of sectors. It could be a few years, it could be longer. It all depends on the client.
And do you think that you could, you know, across all these, you said number one, we're across all assets, right? Are there enough funds and products across all assets to get to 100% impact and not sacrifice return?
Absolutely. I think there are a handful of sub-asset classes where there's less opportunities. I think one is cash. The other is like more semi-liquid evergreen funds, which we would categorize in alternative credit and alternative equity. I think that is where the industry could use more options. There's tons in venture capital, but the place where it's slightly more challenging is in cash, like true impact in a cash product, as well as alternative credit and alternative equity, whereby your capital might be locked up for a year or two and you're getting nice yield and distributions. That's the area which is incredibly important for us when we think about asset allocation, where there's just less opportunities than there are in you know, private debt and particularly venture capital.
What about private equity? Was that one of the things you mentioned, or is that sort of buyout-oriented deals?
Private equity plays an important role in a portfolio. Like, we will always have a recommended, you know, portion in that sub-asset class. And we're going to see more and more impact private equity funds every year. We saw it last year, and we will continue to see more and more. Challenge will be to find the ones that are truly intentional. But the answer is yes, and you're able to put more capital in them because they're much larger.
And so even for CapRock, which is a focus on impact, the non-impact bucket is bigger than the impact bucket. How do you talk to impact general partners about sort of maximizing their share of wallet
across both categories if they're achieving good fundamental economic returns?
You know, while we have, and the industry has evolved significantly since we started investing in impact managers in 2008, there's a lot more opportunities than there were, you know, 10 to 15 years ago when you had a lot more first-time fund managers. You know, now we have a lot of managers, particularly ICM ones that are on fund four and fund five. And so to your question, it's the proof is in the pudding, and that's in the numbers, both in your track record in terms of financial returns, as well as the impact you've generated. So measurable results are incredibly important, financial as well as impact. Like top of the agenda item is, you know, can you highlight what you've done to date from an impact and a financial perspective? And again, there's a wider population today that has that track record than there was 10 to 15 years ago.
So it's a matter of time as these funds develop their track records, it becomes more competitive in the traditional space. Now, if you're coming back to that family that's come to you with $100 million, I'm glad you mentioned that my family foundation is at that level. So I appreciate that. How do you think about working with a family on translating their philanthropic and sort of social or non-financial goals with their financial goals?
Well, we don't believe that you have to sacrifice whatsoever your financial goals to have an impact portfolio, even a 100% impact portfolio. And, you know, over the last few years, we've worked internally with our, you know, at the firm in terms of reporting to show the results on behalf of many of our managers that have delivered their target return, which is on the same level playing field as a conventional fund manager in that respective asset class, and in many cases outperformed that asset class, just like I gave the example of VisionRidge outperforming a real assets target. That proof is really powerful to show clients and to really, you know, move away from that concern that you have to sacrifice financial returns in order to have an impact portfolio.
And so, but could I say I'm really interested in the environment or interested in education, then you could actually pick like VC, private equity, cash for each of those different categories?
Absolutely. Even narrower. We can even find things that are more close to home for you if it's really specific, but absolutely.
What's the oddest request you've ever gotten?
I don't want to call it oddest, but we have this amazing family that we're water. Access to clean water is incredibly important to them, and particularly for the most vulnerable populations on the planet. That's also in the United States. Think of a lot of the American Indian population who are living in drought areas to sub-Saharan Africa. Water is important to this family for numerous reasons. And so they were super excited when they learned that we could first off build a 100% impact portfolio. This is one of those groups that was, hey, day one, let's build a 100% impact portfolio. But what's most important for us is, can you deliver on a portfolio that has water investments in different asset classes? And the cherry on top of that cake will be something that has to do with access to clean water in the most difficult areas on the planet. And we knew of a few opportunities that were available when we were speaking with this client before they hired us. And sure enough, within 6 months, we were able to partner with Water Equity as part of water.org and participated in their Global Access Fund. Just, you know, again, not the oddest request, but, you know, that's very focused, like access to clean water in the poorest of the poor communities on the planet. Can you find something that we can put in our balance sheet? And sure enough, we did it with Water Equity.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable that Caprock can sort of help clients with a very diverse range of needs. But sometimes those needs can shift, or the whims, not whims, but sort of interest areas of a client can shift. You know, you mentioned gender lens, for example. Opportunity zones were really huge. Post-George Floyd, DEI-focused funds were very en vogue. How do you kind of adjust your focus as kind of your clients change what they're interested in and keep sort of relationships between old and new?
Yeah, when we were chatting, there is this shiny object syndrome that pops up all the time. And in some cases, it is totally validated. There are decades in the making for more capital to go to DEI funds and backing businesses by diverse owners and diverse leaders. And so I sure heck, that does not go away as it being a shiny object. But yeah, opportunity zone funds were the rage. And that was what everyone was talking about, meetings, conferences, you name it, for about a year in 2017, 2018. Then there was the huge focus on gender lens investing, and of course, a well-needed focus on DEI funds. And it seems, and of course, 2020, the year of education funds, because everyone was working from home and were trying to invest in new ed tech technologies because it was so important with remote learning. And then right now, it seems like we are in the year of the growth equity climate fund, or the decarbonization equity fund. That is the shiny object of the day. And of course, decades in the making, we should have been investing in these sectors years ago, just a lot more innovation now. To your point, our job is to remain disciplined, remain focused on diversification. So making sure that we are investing in sectors and impact themes that are important to our clients, but are appropriate for that respective vintage. And again, always coming up with a diversified set of offerings for our clients. And so despite this huge focus on a specific impact theme, my job and the job of my colleagues is, all right, we need to come up with diversified sectors, asset classes, vintages, impact themes on a regular basis. So if we did too much in renewable energy one quarter, well, we're definitely going to need to focus next quarter and do something very different. Think something in aquaculture or in affordable housing. We need to have diverse flavors and opportunities for our impact clients on an ongoing basis. And it's sometimes a challenge because there's so many great things that we read about these days of innovations and impact, but got to remain focused and focus on diversification.
Do you try to encourage your clients to stay focused and not kind of switch around, or is it more of an additive rather than a replacement?
It's complementary. I mean, some of these impact teams are incredibly important for our clients, and we want to deliver on that. But at the same time, we often have to say, okay, well, there is a lot of noise. Let's remove the noise and let's find the best fund or manager in that area that you are incredibly excited about, and kindly be patient, because we want to scan that sector, that area, and find the best opportunity for you. And again, highlight the importance of diversification.
What do you think is going to be next year's impact theme of du jour?
I do not know. I do not know. We will see. I do think, fighting the climate crisis through smart investments will not go away. So my guess is that remains this year. And who knows, we might have a renewed focus on emerging markets, given the geopolitical issues going on in Eastern Europe right now. Who knows?
When you think about, one of the things you've said a few times that really struck me was you try to encourage your clients and back up with results, that there's no sacrificing returns with impact. But clearly that's a concern for many people. How do you think you change the dialogue where someone says impact, concessionary capital? How do you change how your clients fundamentally view the space?
Data and examples, pure examples of smart investments, smart exits, and delivering returns. If it's not in a venture capital or real asset strategy, just consistent, attractive yield, if it's in something that has private debt or fixed income, the proof is in the pudding, it is in the data, and that is on the financial returns that impact managers can deliver the same level and in many cases higher than a conventional manager.
And how do you kind of present that data to your clients? And what are some studies maybe that you kind of use to present that argument?
We use the most important thing possible, and that's, balance sheets.
Cash.
It doesn't get any clearer than financial data points, DPI, distributed income based on your investment, TVPI, MOICs, IRRs. That is what we prove. That's what we use to prove that impact investing can't compete with a conventional investment.
Was there ever a time when you sort of thought you had a great impact story and then you got into it and you realized there's some dark underbelly to what you kind of got yourself into?
Oh God. No, I think every now and then the press will find something to poke at in some specific impact area. Unfortunately, and maybe it's a specific issue and that's always a concern. And we're going to always want to make sure we're communicating with our managers to understand what happened if it's one of their portfolio companies. I haven't seen that yet of a dark underbelly. I think not so extreme is when we hear about some recent investments from our impact managers that are considered gold standard of investing in pure impact, intentional impact. When we look at their portfolio and there's a handful of deals in there that may not have a dark underbelly, but have no defensible impact thesis whatsoever. And that's just as frustrating.
So when if a GP comes to you and says, hey, I'd love to get Mark Berryman and Caprock's attention, what is a way to sort of stand out? Is it that consistent impact, consistent returns, the whole package? What is an example of something that's really stood out to you in a pitch recently that made you kind of pay attention?
Yeah, it's interesting. I often gone back to like a few high level areas when you know deciding about participating in a fund led by manager. It's the people, it's the portfolio, and legal. Let me expand on that. So it's the people. What's their track record? How have they worked together? Again, show us the numbers, the impact generation, as well as the financial returns. If it's a first-time fund manager, let's see what you've done historically. And most importantly, this team, what have you done together? If it is a first-time manager, I think that's very important. So it's the people and their track record. Portfolio, I'm focusing on the pipeline. Where are you going to invest? Why now? Why is it important? How are you going to beat competition? And please share with me your pipeline. You can keep some names confidential. We just want to make sure that you have a line of sight to deliver on your objective, which you have clearly stated in your pitch book in your fund. Show us the pipeline. And third, even though we may not look at a limited partnership agreement on day one, we're going to say we want to see strong governance in your fund documents. The four data points in your deck about terms don't mean anything. The devil's in the details, and it's always in the limited partnership agreement. And we want to make sure that there's very strong governance in there and very clear alignment between the LPs and the GP. I think we're moving away from this, but for years, a lot of investors were just so excited about investing impact funds and often didn't really focus on the legal aspects of it. Because when things hit the fan in year two, year three, you have to go back to the limited partnership agreement, and that can have effects on performance. If there's a key person event or if there is a removal, these things can be incredibly disruptive. So legal is really important. And I don't think people really consider the ramifications when you don't properly review and negotiate and change things in a partnership agreement. So people, portfolio, pipeline, and legal.
What do you think about the recent trend to allocate some portion of your carry to impact metrics?
Love it. People have been talking about it for a very, very long time. I want to say that Jin was, you know, highlighting examples 8 to 10 years ago. It is still far and few between. Very few people do it. And often they'll put it in their pitch that they're going to do it and they end up stop doing it. They actually don't deliver on it. Very few people actually end up doing it. I hope this changes and I hope we see more of it.
And do you think that'll apply both to sort of impact funds and then also sort of, you mentioned earlier that there are a lot of funds that say they're impact, but they're really not. Like, how is that going to be? What do you think the sort of red line is going to be over time between those two groups?
I think this movement and shift to impact verification is going to be really helpful. You know, think of the work that Blue Mark is doing at Tideline. That's going to help have financial returns based on impact performance become more relevant going forward. And having things like carries be based on impact performance, you're going to need a third party review. And so that's going to be really helpful. And we just didn't have that a few years ago. And now we do. I think the challenge will be, again, I see it mainly in the venture space where a fund manager invests in, let's say, 20 or 25 deals, and there's three or five in there that just have a very weak or just lack a pure impact thesis with them. Now, can they still get a carry because the other 18 were amazing and three of those deals were high impact? Probably, but I still don't like to see those three or five deals in that portfolio.
So you hold a grudge.
Yeah, I do. Some of the impact managers have really been leaders in this space, And conventional asset managers look to them as they start thinking about either making specific impact investments in their conventional fund, or they too start launching sustainable or impact funds. They're looking at these leaders. And so if our leaders start distracting on investing in only impact businesses that have a very clear impact thesis, and that company's model is predicated on some sort of impact solution, if they stop doing that and those number of deals in that portfolio become fewer and far between, we're going to have a problem. And so, again, they are beacons. They've been doing this for 10 or 15 years, but people are looking to them, and I hope they remain disciplined.
So last question, I'm going to ask you to pull out your crystal ball again. You said kind of the dividing line was going to be who does an impact report and who doesn't. Today, what percent of private fund managers do an impact report? And 5 years from now, what percent of fund managers do you think will do a third-party verified impact report?
We often hear managers say, you often see it in the, you know, in LinkedIn or somewhere else, like our first impact report. And this is because maybe it's a manager that's on fund one or fund two. But I would say, you know, the vast majority, the super majority, well over 75%, do an impact report. The challenge in some of these reports is it's 50 pages, it's too long, you can get lost in them. Every client of ours is different. Do they have time to go through those reports? But also, what is a challenge is if they have numerous funds within that firm, so like let's say they have three impact funds and it's their annual impact report, but I've only invested in fund two or fund three, and I can't pull out the impact data from the fund I invested in, that's a challenge. And so what we want is very specific impact metrics, outputs and outcomes for that specific fund that we've invested in. So reports are great, they tell wonderful stories, but we want data. And so hopefully a few years from now, things are much more dynamic. There's software, there's portals that people can log into, and that those reports become secondary if you want more color. In terms of verification, I really hope in 5 years, well over 50% of the impact managers are being verified. And I know that may seem like a low number, but it's going to be a challenge. But I do hope well over 50%, you know, 5 years from now, are becoming impact verified by some group that has the credibility and experience to do so.
Yeah, we just went through our first third-party verification. So we'll have
congratulations. To pull. All right.
We'll have to do a whole episode on that with Blue Mark and some of the other folks. So, Mark, this is great. Thank you. You've been a real leader in the space, not just allocating capital, but also contributing to the community for many years. So thank you. And we look forward to the next 90 or so funds that you back, including doubling the ICM membership, perhaps.
Absolutely. Thank you for having us. And again, love what ICM is doing and look forward to participating more with ICM.
This is Marika Spence, Executive Director of Impact Capital Managers. Better Money, Better World is made possible in part by ICM, a nonprofit network of over 60 best-in-class fund managers investing for superior returns and meaningful impact across North America and beyond. Our members share a passion for partnering with entrepreneurs and scaling companies that will realize a more resilient, equitable, and sustainable future. If you enjoyed today's conversation, tune in for the next episode of Better Money, Better World. Tell your friends and visit us online at www.impactcapitalmanagers.com.